So Exodus chapter 4, starting in verse 1. Then Moses answered, "But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" Moses said, "A staff." And God said, "Throw it on the ground." So he did. He threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand and catch it by the tail." So he put out his hand, and he caught it, and it became a staff in his hand again. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again the Lord said to him, "Put your hand inside your cloak." Moses put his hand inside of his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, "Put your hand back inside your cloak." So Moses put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. "If they will not believe you," God said, "or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile River and pour it on the dry ground. And the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground." But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." And the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak." But Moses said, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff with which you shall do these signs." Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are now dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and had them ride on a donkey, and he went back to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the staff of God in his hand. All right, we'll stop there for now. All right, let's recap kind of what we just read. Remember, God told Moses in chapter 3, "You're going to go back to Egypt. You're going to speak to the Israelites. You're going to tell them the plan. Then you're going to go speak to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And you're going to ask him to let the people leave Egypt and go into freedom. And finally, you're going to actually lead the people out, you, Moses, as their leader." God made a few promises to him at the time. He said, "I will be with you the entire time." We talked about that last week. God also promised him that the Israelites were going to believe him. So Moses, whether he was going to trust God in this, we'll see. But God promised, the people will believe you. They'll be convinced by what you say. Well, we start this chapter. Apparently Moses has some doubts, doesn't he? Okay, he starts making excuses right away in verse 1. What if they don't believe me? What if they won't listen to me? What if they don't believe that I saw and talked to God? Okay, what if they don't believe that this plan is yours from God? God doesn't respond directly to his questions, does he? He answers in this sort of object lesson. He says, "What's in your hand?" And Moses says, "Well, it's my staff. I'm a shepherd, you know?" Of course. God tells Moses, "Throw your staff to the ground," and God turns it into a snake. Okay, now, maybe you think Moses was, maybe he was just nearsighted, and when the staff was on the ground, something in his eyes played a trick on him. I don't think so. Okay, he's afraid enough of this realistic-looking snake that he runs away. Okay. God then tells him, "Go catch the snake." And he does. When Moses catches the snake, it turns back into a staff in Moses' hand. Okay, so God does this small miracle for him, and he says, this will be a sign that I'll send with you. Basically, he gives Moses the power to do this whenever he wants. So when he goes back to Egypt, he can do this in front of the Pharaoh, in front of the Israelites, and they'll believe that God is doing something supernaturally. Okay. So he doesn't really answer Moses' questions, does he? God just sort of gives him these signs. And he gives him two others, actually, here. He says, you can do the snake thing. If that's not good enough, you can do this thing where you can put your hand inside of the fold of your cloak, and when you pull it out, you're going to have leprosy on the back of your hand. You guys know what leprosy is? It's an infectious skin disease. Back in that time, basically they put people out into leper colonies if they had leprosy because it was incurable, so that they wanted people to stay away from others that had leprosy. So he's telling Moses, put your hand inside your cloak, pull it out, and you'll have leprosy. See? That'll convince them. He says, that's not all of it, though. Pull your hand back inside a second time, and when you take it out, it'll be cured. Okay, there was no cure for leprosy. So what's the bigger miracle here? God giving him leprosy or God taking away the leprosy? You can decide that if you want. That's the second sign that he gives. Third sign, he'll turn water into blood. Go get some water from the Nile River. Fill up your Nalgene. Bring it back to Pharaoh. Dump it on the ground. It will turn into blood. Okay, so three signs. That's what God gives him. He says, you can do these three things. That'll convince the people. That'll convince Pharaoh. Now, the point is this. Moses is supposed to go back to Egypt, and when he goes, he's not going alone. Okay, God is going to be with him to do these things for him, and he's even revealing ahead of time some of the things that should put Moses' mind at ease. Okay? All Moses has to do is trust God. I think Moses trusted God that God had a plan. I think Moses didn't trust God that God would carry out the plan the way he's saying. And so he has hesitations here still. Moses still doesn't feel good about this. So in verse 10, he starts making up even more excuses. Okay, he says, wait, but I'm not good at talking. Okay, I all the way in my past, I failed my freshman year speech class at Stout. I don't even talk to my girlfriend on the phone. We just text because I can't think of what to say. It just comes out wrong. Moses is married with children. He says, I'm not good at talking, God. Don't you want somebody that's better at talking? God's response, who is it that gives a person their voice? Obvious answer, it's God. God's the one that does it. God tells him that. He says, I'll be with you to speak. I can do a lot more than just that, but I'll do that for you if that's what you want. After a while, it starts to seem like Moses has kind of made up his mind. He's just not going to do this. He's thinking of different excuses. He's trying to come up with all the different ways, reasons why he can't. When he finally runs out of excuses, he just sort of says it. God, I don't want to. Send somebody else. I'm sorry. You have answers for all my questions, but just send somebody else. That'll be a whole lot easier for me. And it says in verse 14, at this point, God becomes angry with Moses. Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a little while. But he still hasn't given up on Moses. He's not done trying to walk Moses through this process. He continues offering help. So God has his alternate suggestion here. He says, okay, how about your brother Aaron? Aaron is super eloquent. He's great with the ladies. Okay, he gets, it's a joke, guys. Aaron can speak. You know this. I know this. Isn't it interesting that God says, I know that he's a great speaker. Okay, God knows Aaron and that he's a good speaker. Well, presumably because God gave him that gift or whatever. But so God offers to have Moses' brother Aaron be the spokesperson for Team Israel when they go head-to-head against Team Egypt in the Olympics. From now on, here's how this is going to work. Moses is going to hear from God the plan. He's going to tell his brother Aaron what the plan is. Aaron's going to speak out loud to the people that are in front of him, the Israelites, the Egyptians, and so on. It's like a little game of telephone each time it happens. But Moses is told, you'll be like God to him. Moses is like God, Aaron is like God's prophet speaking to the people. Just a quick side note on this. Now, Moses' unwillingness to be the one speaking, well, we find out later that he's actually pretty good at speaking. You read on in Exodus, not so much Leviticus, but Numbers and Deuteronomy, Moses makes these great speeches. They're almost long sermons. He's pretty good with his words. He doesn't struggle in those situations. But his unwillingness to speak here introduces a whole new set of problems that he's going to have to face in the near future here. His brother Aaron will serve him faithfully. He'll serve God faithfully. Yet Aaron also brings a lot of his own baggage into the equation. When the Israelites come out of Egypt and they're going to worship God on the mountain, guess who is the lead advocate for creating a golden calf to worship? It's Aaron. He says, "This is the God that brought you out." And God's like, "No, it's not." Moses is like, "No, it's not." Moses is like, "I didn't tell you to say that." Aaron brings in all these problems. He also brings some sort of disunion, disharmony with Moses' family as time goes on. He serves Moses well, and he serves God well, and yet there's mistakes and hiccups along the way. But just know this, okay? When it comes to saying yes to God and his plan, you pick his best. These side distractions, these extra problems, they tend to be limited or non-existent. You start going with God's plan B or God's plan C, and I've got time to really parse this out, but it's always going to invite some differing problems, some new trouble that you wouldn't have had you said yes to God's plan. And God's super patient with him here, isn't he? God's willing to work with him. Moses is afraid. Moses is resistant. God's still going to use him and still going to bless him along the way. And yet, there's new problems Moses has to deal with because he was resistant, reluctant to go with God's plan in the first place. But Aaron will now assist Moses. The last thing we see in what we read is Moses goes back to his father-in-law, the guy named Jethro, and he asks him for permission to go to Egypt. Okay. He asks his father-in-law. Now, Moses is an 80-year-old man. I hope when I'm 80 years old, I am not asking my father-in-law for permission to go on a vacation. Okay. Well, this wasn't a vacation, but to do anything, actually. Even as now, I hope I'm not asking that. He didn't have to do this. God's response is, one more time, okay, Moses, trust me, it'll be fine. Now go to Egypt. Okay, that's God's response to this. I think Moses is still dragging his feet a little bit. I think he's still fishing around for ways and reasons and excuses as to why he won't have to go to Egypt. But he runs out of them, and so finally he goes. He gets on a donkey, hops on the 4-lane, Moses, his wife, his kids, they head over to Egypt, okay? Now, what do we want to pull out of this? That's the story. That's the big picture. I think the way Moses is trying to make excuses is probably the most prominent issue we see here, at least the on the surface of it. He, no doubt, was having a difficult time with God's plan. It's a lot to take in, no doubt. God was incredibly patient, incredibly gracious with him, though. I mean, if God gave me this amount of attention in a sort of a back and forth exchange, I hope I do better than Moses is doing here. God's not rushing him through this. God's walking him slowly and surely, steadily. He's helping Moses stay upright through each step here. But Moses is struggling with this, and he just makes a whole bunch of excuses because he either is too afraid to do it, he doesn't want to do it. Who knows? And my question for you is, can you relate to this? That there might be something that you're being asked to do or you think you should do, something you feel like God's leading you into. You believe God wants you to do it, but you're either scared, you're hesitant. Maybe it's something totally different than the way you want to spend your life, and so you just actually don't want to do it. And so you start to make excuses as to why. Or why you can't do it now. Maybe be another version of that. Now I'm going to say something, and I think you're going to agree with me on this. But at the same time, it's going to sound a little bit harsh. And so there might be the temptation to either resist it or to doubt it or just to dismiss it altogether. You ready for it? You're like, what could you possibly say that's going to be that bad? Maybe it won't be that bad. Not every excuse is a legitimate excuse. Not every excuse is a legitimate excuse. We live in a world where as long as you have a reason or an excuse that sounds semi-legitimate, you can get off the hook from anything you want. You can get out of any responsibility. You can do whatever you want. You can back away from commitments. You can get out of anything that you want as long as you have an excuse. But not every excuse is legitimate. Common excuses: I had a previous commitment. Okay, there's a conflict in my schedule. I don't know what my schedule is going to be like, and I'm sorry if I was talking to some of you earlier and we were having this conversation that nothing to do with you. Or is it? There's uncertainty in your future, and so you just can't quite make... I'm not saying that's not a reason to be cautious about what you're committing to, but I'm saying that's not an excuse to wait forever to start doing what you know you should be doing. There's all sorts of excuses, aren't there? And it's easy to want to hide behind them, isn't it? Because it's the moment we step forward into things, the moment we stop making the excuses and face up to what we think we should do, well, things start to get a little real, don't they? Once we verbalize these things, once we talk to other people about them, well, now there's some expectation from them as to whether or not I'll do them. Let me give you a few examples, or not examples, scenarios. Not every excuse is legitimate. Okay, just because you made previous plans doesn't mean you have to keep them. If something more important comes along, you can reschedule the lesser plans that you had. Now, not everything is equal in planning. Some things are more flexible than others. But some things are just not as important as other things. And so if something more important comes along, you can reschedule and rearrange the lesser important things. I already started talking about this one. Just because there's uncertainty in your future, you don't know how things are going to work out, doesn't mean you have to hold off making commitments now. Again, use caution. Don't overcommit. Don't overextend yourself. But yet, you're just going to wait till a future time where life is uncomplicated. You're going to arrive at the point where you think it's supposed to be uncomplicated only to find out that it still is. You're just putting it off indefinitely into the future. Just because you think you're not ready for something doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. Okay, when it comes to following God, you're never ready in a sense that everything that He asks of you, you're 100% comfortable with. That'll never happen. If you don't think you're ready to step forward into what God is asking of you, that's excellent. You're not ready, and you should step forward into it. Okay, and everybody feels that way, but a lot of people are going to use the "I'm not ready yet" excuse. In God's kingdom, there's no legitimate excuses for saying no to God. Moses was off base on everything here. We talked about this last week. God created us. He gets to decide what we do, how we do it, where we do it, when we do it. If God is the creator of all things and control of everything, if He's good and wishes my best, if He's wisest and knows all, wouldn't you want to do it His way? Or do you think you know better than God? Super prideful position to take, by the way. Moses says no to God here. Okay, he starts making the excuses. He finally gets to the "I don't want to." Okay, I'm not going to lie about it anymore. I just don't want to do it. Okay, I don't have to wash my hair. My dog's not sick. Okay, my cat doesn't have a play date. I just don't want to. And so at least he's honest, right? God is patient the whole time. God is even helpful with him the whole time. God doesn't throw him aside for this. But there comes a point where God gets frustrated with him. God gets angry. It's in verse 14. And I think that's a surprising thing for some of us, this idea that God would get angry or frustrated with us. Okay, isn't he a loving God? Doesn't he understand that Moses was just sort of scared or didn't quite have enough information or needed more time? God is angry because Moses isn't listening to him. Moses is ignoring what he says. God has a response for every concern Moses has, and he's just ignoring it. And Moses is making excuses as to why he can't. On the flip side of that, some of us, we just assume God's angry with us all the time, as if we're so terrible that there must be just something inherently about us that God can't work with or won't work with, is unwilling to work with. God must be unhappy and probably just doesn't like us. Some of us lean toward that side of it. God isn't a grumpy God. He doesn't get angry for no reason at all. If that's you, snap out of it. Stop it. That's the best way to say that. But it is important to know God's not a passive bystander. He's not passively letting you throw all your trash at him and having no reaction to it at all. If you do something that displeases God, he has every right to be displeased, even angry. A lot of us, we just expect God to take whatever we throw at him and be okay with it. What if you did that to your friends? Well, if they're a good enough friend, they will take it, but that doesn't mean they won't react. God will react. Some things please him, some things displease him. And Moses found out his complaining, his excuses, God was displeased. God was even angry, and rightfully so. But God doesn't give up on him. And I wonder for us, do you make excuses as to why can't obey God or you won't obey God? Do you make excuses as to why you can't participate in the things God's doing? Do you do this to the extent Moses did, where it might even test God's patience? It put him on the verge of anger or displeasure. Listen to what Jesus says about people who make excuses. This is from Luke chapter 9, verses 59 through 62. Some of you might know this. Jesus said to a guy, "Come follow me." The man agreed, but he said, "Lord, first let me return home and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Let the spiritually dead bury their own dead. Your duty is to follow me, to go and to preach the kingdom of God." Another guy heard Jesus say this, and he said, "Yes, Lord, I will follow you, but first, let me say goodbye to my family." Okay, but Jesus told him, "Anyone who puts their hand to the plow and looks back is not fit for the kingdom of God." So these two people hear Jesus say, "Follow me." Pretty simple. In that day and age, they would have known this because there were people following Jesus. So when Jesus says, "Follow me," just look around and do what everybody else is doing. It's not hard. You're like, "Follow you? What do you mean? Follow me." First guy says he wants to bury his father first. Second guy says he wants to go home and say goodbye to his family first. Neither of these seem horrible on the surface, do they? Okay. But Jesus doesn't accept either of these excuses. He doesn't accept either of them. Back then, the burial process took about a year. For Jewish people, first they buried the body. A year later, once the body decomposed, then they took the bones and put it in a little crypt, and that finished the burial process. First guy was saying, "I'll think about following you next year." That's kind of the idea. Second guy, he was telling Jesus that, "Hey, I'll catch up with you later. I got some places to be. I got some people I need to go check in with." Jesus says to both of these guys, those are not legitimate excuses. If you're going to put your family before me, you're not worthy to even be following me. He says it's more important to follow God than even the relationship, you know, with your own family. Jesus says more important to love God than it is to love your own family. When it comes to making excuses in this day and age that we live in, here in Midwest America, I know some of you are not from Midwest America, but here in Wisconsin, the number one excuse people make for not following God is their family. Top excuse above everything. We live in this culture where family has become a cult. You know why people use this excuse? Because they assume it's legitimate. Even as, you know, Christians or even as non-Christians, you assume, well, nothing's more important than my family. We've been indoctrinated with this cult doctrine that says your family is more important than anything else in the entire world. And that's at odds with what Jesus says. Listen to what else Jesus says. If you love your father more than me, if you love your mother more than me, you're not worthy of me. If you love your son more than me, if you love your daughter more than me, you're not worthy of me. He says to the parents, don't love your children more than you love me. He says to the children, don't love your parents more than you love me. This is the teaching of Jesus. He doesn't teach love your family first. Family is super important, and you should love them. But you know what's more important than family? God. Fill in the blank. You know what's more important than fill in the blank? God. He's more important even than family. Many people disagree with Jesus about this. Many people, even Christians, or people that consider themselves to be Christians, they disagree with Jesus about this. Now, I understand there's two sides to this. One would be agreeing with Jesus or not. The other thing would be living this out. Because easier said than done, that's for sure. This isn't a super easy thing to walk with God, to love him first, and to experience the pressures of your family trying to get all your time, control your life, trying to get you to do what they want you to do. It's easier to give in to them. And it's easier to give in to them because the culture says, yeah, they're your family. What are you doing? Jesus says otherwise. Jesus is not at odds with your family, but he says, love God first, and I bet you you'll do a better job loving your family than you did if you didn't. Now, interestingly enough here, Moses tries using the family excuse here. Did you guys catch that? The very end of the section we read? The conversation with God is over. Moses has all the information he needs to know. And what does he do? He goes back to his father-in-law and starts asking him, hey, you think it'd be a good idea if I went to Egypt? What do you think he's doing there? You think he really needed permission? I think he's still looking for an excuse. I think he's trying to make family responsibility his excuse. If Jethro says, nah, you can't go, we need you around here, then Moses can say, God, I'm sorry. My father-in-law, he's getting old. Can't quite tend the sheep as good as he used to. Besides, the staff that we own, you turned it into a snake. It's kind of malfunctioned sometimes. I'm needed here. I can't go. Moses tries to use the family excuse. I believe wholeheartedly that's what he's doing. Because right after that, God tells him for the 74th time, everything is going to be okay. I can't believe how patient God was with him. It's amazing. A few final questions on this section, and we'll move on. Do you use family as an excuse for not following God? Do you let your family get in the way of your relationship with God? I know what I'm saying is not easy to take. I think Jesus knew that when he said it. But he's trying to disarm this idea that you love and serve your family above everything else. No, you don't. You serve God above everything else. You love your family in the appropriate ways. You give them the attention that you should. But God is God. Family is not God. Do you let your family get in the way of your relationship with God? All right, we're going to try and move forward here and finish this thing up. Our man Moses here, he drug his feet among his multiple attempts at making excuses. He tries to play the family card. Fortunately, probably fortunately for him, it doesn't work. He goes to Egypt, just as God has instructed him. Now, there's a couple of difficult things coming up here in these next couple of paragraphs, so bear with me. We'll read them and we'll talk through them as we go. But Moses is on his way to Egypt. Let's pick it up in verse 21. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the miracles that I have put in your power. But I will harden your heart, I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son, and I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son.'" All right, Moses on his way to Egypt. God gives him some final reminders, kind of gives him some expectations of how it's going to go when he gets there. Perform the three miracles, Moses. Pharaoh's not going to let the people go, and I'm going to harden his heart. And then warn the Pharaoh that if he won't let my firstborn son, the nation of Israel, go, then I'm going to kill his firstborn son. Okay, and that's actually a pre-warning for the 10th plague that we'll see in about a month when we get to the plagues. Okay, difficulties here. This idea of God hardening Pharaoh's heart. The question comes up, does this mean Pharaoh didn't have a choice in the matter? God just made him be a grumpy, evil dictator, and he couldn't relent even if he wanted to? Is that what that means? God hardened Pharaoh's heart? In this case, the answer is no. The word harden here actually means confirm. When we read through these chapters coming up, I don't know why they translate it harden all the time. Sometimes it means like harden as in close your heart off to everything else, and that's when Pharaoh does it to himself. Sometimes it means confirm. And so when God hardens Pharaoh's heart, it means he confirms Pharaoh's heart. Well, what does that mean? It just means God wasn't going to do anything to try and convince Pharaoh otherwise. He wasn't going to reach in and change Pharaoh's heart. He was going to let him make his own decision for himself and confirm that. God confirmed Pharaoh's heart. That's the idea there. Okay, God isn't going to do anything to change Pharaoh's mind. And we'll talk about this some more because we will have multiple chapters on this as we get moving forward. Secondly, God threatens to kill Pharaoh's son. Okay, does this make God sound like he's a bloodthirsty and a vengeful God? I guess something you should think about, something I would ask that you think about, Pharaoh's not a nice man. The whole problem here is that he's enslaved a nation of 2 million people and committed to killing off all the firstborn sons that they're having while they live in his country. Pharaoh's actively murdering, is as close to genocide, the nation of Israel. And so the question is God really being unfair to turn the tables back on Pharaoh and do the same thing to Pharaoh that Pharaoh was doing to the nation of Israel? Is that unfair of God? Pharaoh's evil and already doing this. Well, I don't think so. If there's a disconnect between two parties, if there's miscommunication or lack of communication or lack of agreement, what's the fairest thing that can happen between those two parties? Well, I would say you treat the other the way that they're treating you. You do what the other is doing to you. Instead of doing more than they're doing to you, you meet them with what they're doing. Instead of doing less or differently, at least you honor the fact that that's who they are, that's what they're doing. Pharaoh's an evil man. He needs to either stop or he needs to change, and he's not going to change. And so he needs to stop, even if that means he needs to die. And you might think that doesn't sound like a very Christian thing to say, but I assure you, it's not unchristian. I don't know if anybody have ever heard this story before? Back in World War II, Adolf Hitler was leading the Nazis in Germany. They were persecuting the Jews, killing the Jews by the millions, not by a little, but by a lot. And I'm sure there were multiple plots for this, but there was a plot to assassinate Hitler. Anybody hear this story? You want to know who was at the center of this plot to assassinate Hitler? A Christian pastor from Germany named Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Famous world theologian, wrote tons of books, influential and all the rest. It actually got him imprisoned, I believe, and he actually died about a week or two before World War II came to an end. But this Christian pastor decided he was going to be part of the plot to kill an evil dictator that was murdering millions. You might say, well, does being Christian mean I shouldn't murder? Well, yeah, you don't murder. But this situation is not that simple. This is evil, and it needed to be stopped. And this is God, not a human, making this decision. This is God deciding he's going to step in and do something to stop the evil Pharaoh. Now, additionally here, he doesn't immediately just kill the Pharaoh's son. Okay, God will send Moses, him, and Aaron. They'll talk to Pharaoh multiple times. In fact, they'll talk 10 times to Pharaoh before this actually plays out in this specific instance. God is patient with Pharaoh. God lets him have time to change, but yet God lets him make his own decisions, and Pharaoh does exactly that. So God starts to apply some pressure. He gives him 9 plagues before we ever get to this moment. Well, we'll deal with some of this stuff again in the coming months. We'll get to some plagues. We'll talk about frogs, gnats, darkness. It's pretty cool. If you haven't read this, this is some crazy stuff coming. Let's keep going. Verse 24, another difficult passage, almost bizarre, you might say, but let's read it. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So God let him alone. It was then that she said, "A bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." Okay, so apparently they're traveling towards Egypt. God confronts Moses and he's going to kill him. Anybody know this one already? Moses is dying, and I don't know, it doesn't say. His wife figures out the reason why he's dying. Apparently, it's because his 2 sons have not been circumcised. Okay, so she grabs a knife. These are adult male men. I don't know how old they were, 20, 30, 40. And she circumcises her 2 sons. She takes the cut-off foreskin, throws it at Moses' feet, and yells at him, basically. "You're a bridegroom of blood." Okay, and then God relents, Moses lives, and that's the end of this little episode. Then it's going to go back into the rest, the regularly scheduled programming here in just a minute. Well, the issue here seems to be Moses hadn't circumcised his son. Okay, he's an Israelite man. He married a non-Israelite woman, although Zipporah is a descendant of Abraham. That's from Genesis chapter 25. We actually learned that on Sunday if you were at Believer City Church. God established circumcision as a sign of the covenant that he made with his people in the Old Testament. Genesis chapter 17, he talks to Abraham. He says, "This is the sign of the covenant I'm making with you. All of your firstborn sons are to be circumcised. You're going to walk forward through the generations with this being the outward sign that you're my people, that you're obedient to me, and that you're committed to following me. Anybody that doesn't circumcise their sons, they'll be cut off from my people." That's Genesis chapter 17. What this means, in short, is that in the Old Testament, God made an agreement with his chosen people. That's what we call a covenant. It's a mutual agreement. Marriage would be a modern-day covenant, an agreement. The people would fulfill certain conditions as a sign of obedience to God and as an affirmation that they were committed to following him. Okay, they wanted to continue on in this. Moses had not done that. Okay, this is 400 and some years after Abraham. Moses is now on his way to represent God to Abraham's descendants, the people of Israel, and he's going to lead them as their spiritual leader, as their, you know, civil leader, and he hasn't obeyed God. And I don't know why God waited until now, but God apparently is angry with him, and he says he sets himself to kill him. Now, Moses' wife sort of saves the day, but most scholars actually believe that the reason why she knew this was disobedience to God, and this was the reason why God was coming after him, was because she was the source of the disobedience. As a non-Israelite, that she probably had decided not to have her sons circumcised, and so whatever happened, God communicates this to her. She somehow, I don't know, understands it. She steps in and saves the day, but really it was her, likely her disobedience that led to this. All right, so what spiritual lesson do we get out of this? What do we take away from this? Well, simply, obeying God is a serious thing. This isn't the only, you know, out there bizarre, if not scary, episode in the Bible where you read it and you're like, what the heck? You get to the New Testament, there's times where it says some people took communion wrong and God killed them. There's a people that give money to the church and they lie about the amount they gave to the church and God killed them. God's the creator of life. God's the sustainer of life. When a person dies, I don't know what you believe about how that happened, if it was totally in humanity's control or this earthly control, but there's a sense in which God stopped sustaining their life, and so he also decided no matter what circumstance a person died under, that their time was up. It's complicated. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to oversimplify it. But these stories in the Bible, where it's sort of, we don't have all the details, and it sort of seems hard to understand. It's either crazy or weird. I think another thing we can take away from this forces us to decide whether we're going to give God the benefit of the doubt or whether we're going to doubt God. We have to decide whether we give God the benefit of the doubt or whether we're going to doubt him because of this kind of bizarre story that we just read. We better finish up the chapter. Verse 27, the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him to speak and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and he did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads, and they worshipped. So God speaks to Aaron now. Okay, God was speaking to Moses. God told Moses Aaron will be on his way soon. We find out that God spoke to Aaron, sent him on his way. Aaron comes out, meets Moses at the mountain of God, that's Mount Sinai. Moses fills him in on all the details. Aaron, I mean, it's not recorded, but Aaron apparently has no hesitations. He's not trying to make excuses. They travel to Egypt, talk to the Israelites, and they're super excited. Wait, you're saying God heard our cries for help? You're saying God's on his way to help us? Okay, it says the people believe that they're from God. And their response is to worship God together. All of Moses' worries were for nothing. Okay, things are going to happen exactly as God promised they would. And so we see here, things are off to a really, really good start. Okay, next on the docket, if you've been following along, they're going to have to go talk to the Pharaoh and convince him. So the people that believe in God are for this. Now they're going to have to go talk to the evil dictator and see what he has to say. But that's next week. So we'll stop there for tonight. Let's pray.